So let us begin. Obviously, there's a lot more to Christianity than can be found in the Christian New Testament. And likewise, there's a lot more to Islam than can be found in their basic book, the Quran. I'm thinking of the values of tradition, culture, community, family, developing history, etc. When Islam expanded beyond Arabia, need for direction led to the growth of what they call the Sunnah. Traditions about Muhammad's teaching and actions, including other sayings, and there are hundreds and thousands of them, that are attributed to Muhammad. Now they come from two centuries, three centuries later, so scholars are always a little bit iffy about how much of them can be trusted to come from Muhammad and how much come from the imagination of people 200 years later. You can picture that. But that's all part of their tradition. I've chosen to focus on the Christian New Testament because of the special place it has in Christianity, and on the Quran because of its special foundational place in Islam. Now, I can manage New Testament Greek, so the New Testament side of things I hope I can present with some, let's say, authority even. But I don't speak Arabic, and I'm not a Muslim. And when you look at any religion from the outside, there's always a big danger that you don't really comprehend its heart. So obviously that's the case with me. But what I've done is, this is called the Study Quran. It's 2,000 pages long and very small print, I can assure you. Mm-hmm. And it's all done by Muslim scholars. So any time I put a quotation up from the Quran, it comes from, this is 2015, so it's modern, recent, and authoritative from the Muslim point of view. So I'll always quote from this book, the text. I was tempted initially, because the English is actually not that good. It's a pity, it's such a beautiful book. But anyhow, I think the English is quite defective. Translation is no doubt accurate, but the English is not too good. I was tempted to improve, and I thought, no, wait a minute, I won't. So I'll leave it exactly as you'll find anything in here, so that you know that I'm quoting the Quran in English by scholars, Islamic scholars. And that's the book there. The Study of Quran, a new translation and commentary. The editor-in-chief is Sayed Hossein Nasr, and it's produced by HarperCollins, 2015. And I exaggerated a moment ago, I said it has 2,000 pages. It's actually 1,996. Now, because on the level of human interaction, Muslims and Christians can share, of course, many values. My intention has been to study the New Testament and the Quran with a view to writing something that, in however small a way, might help Christians and Muslims appreciate each other's religious heritage. I've been working on this, by the way, for 3 years. The world, our common home, needs us to share our insights, to help one another correct what may be wrong in our thinking, particularly our thinking of the other, to rejoice in what we share, and I hope you'll see some of that, and to respect one another in our differences. There are a number of religious communities, as you well know, that look to the Christian New Testament for inspiration. This is probably not a surprise to you, but I'm a Catholic Christian. But I hope that all Christians will be at home with what I have to say about the New Testament. Likewise, there are a number of religious communities that look to the Quran for inspiration. And my desire has been, and is still, to reach out to them. Let's begin with a major problem. A major problem for both Christians and Muslims is that Islam has in recent times been hijacked by Salafi and Wahhabi sects that have taken control of Arabia, the birthplace of Islam. They make up only about 5% of Islam, but their determination to wipe out non-Muslims and to force their violent interpretation of the Quran on other Muslims has coloured everyone's view of Islam. One danger is that this can easily encourage the impression that there's no common ground and no hope of productive dialogue. The only solution, according to some, is to meet violence with greater violence. And we've seen masses of that in the last 10 years, as you well know. Now, just as it is necessary for followers of Jesus to be critical of those who, in the name of Christianity, reject non-Christians and other Christians who do not agree with their narrow-minded, bigoted views, so it's important that the Muslim community distance itself from those who, in the name of Islam, attack non-Muslims and Muslims who do not agree with their determination in the name of Islam to wipe out all who disagree with them. Now, I can say that, but I'll read you now from a current Islamic member called Ed Hussein. He's written a book published this year called The House of Islam, A Global History. I don't have a copy of it here to show you. Now, he defines jihadis as those who are committed to purify the majority of Muslims who they claim have drifted from the true faith. They are themselves, they see themselves as being loyal to Islam by opposing infidels. Being on friendly terms with non-Muslims is prohibited. Instead of following the traditional understanding in Islam that behaviour is permitted unless explicitly prohibited, they teach that everything is prohibited unless explicitly permitted. I'm obviously not quoting from Hussein here, but this is an honest summary of what he says. I'll quote him in a moment. They go, these jihadis, they go so far as to declare Muslims who do not agree with them to be unbelievers, who are to be killed. It's not enough for them to leave judgment to God in the next life. They are committed to create God's government here on earth, according to their understanding of Sharia law. Sharia is actually a very beautiful word in Arabic. It means a path that leads to the water. You can imagine in a desert area how important that is. So Sharia is the way, in their view, that leads to the water of life. So that's the law they want to live under, and they want the whole world to live under it. Let me quote Hussein here. He writes, "We cannot reverse the rising tide of jihadism unless we uproot its theology and ideology. As long as the House of Islam provides shelter for Salafi jihadis, the rest of the world will attack Islam and Muslims. As long as Muslims tolerate their presence, we will give license even to the ideologues in both East and West to conflate Islam with Salafi jihadism. More Muslims will turn to jihadism, and another generation will be lost." He continues, "We need to cleanse our mosques, publishing houses, schools, websites, satellite TV stations, madrasas and ministries of Salafi jihadi influence. Unless we do, Islamophobia will continue to rise, and we cannot complain when the West repeatedly suggests that Muslims are suspect. Unless we do, no matter how much Muslims protest, they'll continue to share the opprobrium heaped on those who claim to represent us. Unless we do," he says, "we cannot credibly claim that they have nothing to do with us. Sadly," he concludes, "they do come from within us." Hussein also writes, "The attraction of Islam lies in the simplicity of its message of worship of one God, a preserved Quran, an honoured prophet, a celebrated family life, and emphasis on the soul's journey to the next life." He goes on to state, "The centrality of God, the vibrancy of the Quran, the preservation of the rights of the sacred, the institutions of the family, and the firm public belief in the afterlife all provide an unshakable bedrock for the Muslim believer from generation to generation." Just as there have always been, and still are, extraordinarily holy people in all branches of Christianity, so it is for Islam. I'd like to begin by offering hope by recalling one among a number of movements within Islam that have been more open to Christianity and more committed to peace than the ones we've just been describing. Personally, I have found special inspiration in the writings of the followers of the Muslim Sufi way. They focus especially on the spiritual, mystical dimension of the Islamic faith. A Sufi Muslim, Llewellyn Vaughan Lee, in 2012, wrote a book called The Prayer of the Heart in Christian and Sufi Mysticism. Cynthia Bourgeois, an American Episcopalian priest, in her introduction writes to that book, "Sufism arose in the cradle of Islam to receive and nurture those teachings of the heart that had first been planted in those Near Eastern lands directly from the living heart of Jesus." You may not have noticed in my initial presentation, see, Muhammad is 600 years after Jesus. So Christianity was in Arabia for 550, whatever how many years, prior to Islam, and had influenced the Arabian people. Sufism and Christianity, she says, are joined at the heart. They're kindred pathways of transfiguration through love. Both traditions picture the spiritual journey with the same core metaphor as a cosmic love song that begins in exile and ends in divine intimacy. Another modern Sufi Muslim, Kabir Helminski, in a book called The Knowing Heart, A Sufi Path of Transformation, published in 1999, writes, "The lives and teachings of Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad have influenced and transformed so many billions of people. Why? Because they're essentially teachings of love." Especially inspiring is the love poetry of the Sufi saint Jalaluddin Rumi in his 492-page book, Rumi, The Big Red Book, the great masterpiece celebrating mystical love and friendship, published in 2010, Coleman Barks, a Sufi Muslim, tells why he was drawn to this mystical arm of Islam. He writes, "I've been drawn to the Sufis for their emphasis on the numinous, as it transpires through beauty and harmony and love. I find that when I am around them, and around Taoist and Zen masters also, the possessiveness of the ego lessens, and I feel joy overflowing through the createdness. And that feels like the soul's truth." Barks also describes what Rumi's son Sultan Velad felt when Shams, Rumi's spiritual teacher and intimate friend, spoke the Quran and the sayings of Muhammad to him. And he writes, "He sowed new love in my soul. He revealed secrets. He made me fly without wings and reach the ocean where no boundaries, where I found peace, and where I found peace, and like a bird freed from a trap, felt safe from all its dangers." I wonder how many Muslims over the centuries have been similarly moved by listening to the Quran. Rumi is beautifully respectful of Jesus and of the Christian New Testament. And these are words from Rumi, quoted by Barks. Rumi wrote, "The miracle of Jesus is himself." He also wrote, "Inside the friend where rose and thorn blend, to one opening point, the Quran, the New Testament and the Old, flow together to become one text." Rumi's key insight is perhaps best expressed when he writes, "Is there love, a drawing together of any kind, that is not sacred?" Hussein, whom I've referred to already, writes of Ibn Arabi, a contemporary of Rumi, a Sufi Muslim. He writes, he had, like many Sufis, a special inclination towards the spiritual Jesus. Jesus was my first master on the way, writes Arabi. It was in his hands that I was converted. He watches over me and at all hours and not leaving me for a second. I often met him in my visions. It was with him, that's with Jesus, that I repented. He commanded me to practice asceticism and renunciation. He whom I, God, love, I am the eye with which he sees, the ears with which he listens. Ibn Arabi is remembered to this day across the Muslim world for these verses that he wrote in Mecca. For like Rumi, Arabi found God in love. He writes, my heart has become capable of all forms, a prairie for gazelles, a convent for monks, a temple of idols, a Kaaba for the pilgrim, the tablets of the Torah, the book of the Quran. I profess the religion of love, and regardless of which direction its steed may lead, love is my religion and my faith. So I began the evening by highlighting something we're terribly conscious of, this extreme form of Islam that is causing havoc throughout the world now, started there, and the Muslims saying, we've got to get rid of this. Now I've moved to two Sufi Muslims who obviously are in love with Jesus and very aware of his presence, and even in the case of Arabi, look to him as the source of their conversion. Now, I'm not claiming that Rumi and Arabi are typical of Sufis, but they do remind us that it's possible for Christians to influence Muslims. Do I have to remind you, this cannot happen without respect? How can you influence anyone if you don't respect them? It cannot happen without respect, without love. But love is not naive. There are dangerous people around who identify as Christians, and we need to protect the community from them. And the same can be said, as we've already said, of people who claim to be Muslims. But it's still the case that the world needs Christians who are faithful to the mission given them by Jesus, a mission of love. And this is my own view, of course, and has no real value, but I'll offer it. When it comes to community, we have a lot to learn from our Muslim brothers and sisters. Yes, we've got a lot to share with them. We've got Jesus to share with them. How beautiful would that be? We've got things to learn from them. Look, increasingly in the Christian West, so-called, religion is being swept, if not under the carpet, then to the periphery of public life. There's immense pressure to identify religion as an individual affair. The human hunger for personal and therefore communal identity is expressed in many places, but in the song, I am, you are, we are Australian. And the sporting stadiums show how much people need to feel that in their hundreds of thousands in Melbourne anyhow. I think an argument can be made to connect the individualizing of religion and the modern epidemic of loneliness and anxiety, particularly among the young, who aren't, on the whole, churched. Muslims see this lack of communal religion, they see this for what it is, a profound cultural weakness. And they've got a lot to teach us here. I now want to read to you from the Church official documents. Second Vatican Council reminds us, whatever good is found sown in people's minds and hearts, or in the rites and customs of peoples, these are not only preserved from destruction, but are purified, elevated, and perfected for the glory of God. And Pope Paul VI, now Saint Pope Paul VI, expresses current Christian understanding when he writes that people can gain salvation, he's talking about Christianity, in other ways as well, by God's mercy, even though we do not preach the gospel to them. Our privilege as Jesus' disciples is to continue his mission, telling others of him and drawing them into the embrace of his love. While we're faithful to the mission given us, we know that his love is not limited by our efforts. Paul VI continues in the same letter, the Church respects and esteems these non-Christian religions. Of course, brackets, including Islam. Because they're the living expression of the soul of vast groups of people. They carry within them the echoes of thousands of years of searching for God, a quest which is incomplete, but often made with great insincerity and righteousness of heart. They possess an impressive patrimony of deeply religious texts. They have taught generations of people how to pray. They're all impregnated with innumerable seeds of the word and can constitute a true preparation for the gospel. Pope John Paul II, Saint Pope John Paul II writes, the Second Vatican Council recalls that the Spirit is at work in the heart of every person through the seeds of the Word to be found in human initiatives, including religious ones, and in the human effort to attain truth, goodness, and God Himself. The Spirit is at the very source of people's existential and religious questioning, a questioning which is occasioned not only by contingent situations, but by the very structure of what it is to be human. The Spirit is not only instilling a desire for the world to come, but also thereby animating, purifying and reinforcing the noble aspirations which drive the human family to make its life one that is more human and to direct the whole earth to this end. It's the Spirit who sows the seeds of the Word present in various customs and cultures. And he continues, we must have respect for human beings in their quest for answers to the deepest questions of life, and respect for the action of the Holy Spirit in people. Every authentic prayer is prompted by the Holy Spirit, who is mysteriously present in every human heart. And finally, John Paul II, God doesn't fail to make himself present in many ways, and not only to individuals, but also to entire peoples through their spiritual riches, of which their religions are the main and essential expression, even when they contain gaps, insufficiencies, and errors. Dialogue with those of other religions is demanded by deep respect for everything that's been brought about in human beings by the Spirit who blows where he wills. So just as it's necessary for followers of Jesus to be critical of those who in the name of Christianity reject non-Christians and other Christians who don't agree with their narrow-minded, bigoted views, so it's important, and we've touched on this already, that the Muslim community clarify its faith and point to those who distort it by their behaviour. I'll move now briefly, that's my introduction, to introduce Muhammad and the Quran. That map, that is Arabia, obviously, and the little bit encircled with the red is Mecca, where it all began. Muhammad was born in Mecca, Arabia, in 570 AD. His father, Abdullah, died before his birth, and his mother, Amina, died when he was only 6 years old. He was cared for first by his grandfather and then by his uncle. In 595, so he's 25 years old, he married Khadija bint Khuwailid, who was a trader, really, and considerably his elder. They had two sons who died as children and four daughters. And after the death of Khadija in 619, Muhammad then had married many wives, but not while he had that initial relationship with her. Even before his first vision in 610 AD, aged 40, Muhammad used to retire to a cave on Mount Hira. For the next 23 years, till his death, age 63, he saw himself and his disciples saw him as a man inspired. I've got references there to the Quran, and we'll look at them when they come up. He aspired to follow the religion of Abraham. He didn't see himself as starting a new religion. He wanted, and he'd learnt this through Jewish studies, because Jews were very strong in Arabia at the time, and many tribes of them. He wanted to be faithful to Abraham. And he sees Moses as being faithful, but Jews not being faithful to Moses. And he sees Jesus as being faithful, but Christians as not being faithful to Jesus. And many weren't, of course. So that was his view of things. He aspired to follow the religion of Abraham, as revealed by earlier prophets, especially Moses and Jesus, whom he accepted as vehicles of God's revelation. Muhammad saw his role as converting Arabian pagan tribes, who were polytheists, to faith in the one God, and as God's chosen instruments in cleansing Judaism and Christianity of what he judged to be accretions that had brought about division, and what he judged to be distortion of the revelations made through Moses and Jesus. From 610 to 623, Muhammad lived in Mecca, where he was born. Typically, the revelations from that period tend to be more respectful of the Jews and Christians. Here's Surah 16 as an example of that. And it's in italics, straight out of the translation from the study Quran. Call unto the way of thy Lord. This is a revelation from God as he sees it through Gabriel. Call unto the way of the Lord with wisdom and goodly exhortation, and dispute with them in the most virtuous manner. Surely your Lord is he who knows best those who stray from his ways and knows best the rightly guided. Muhammad saw God as inspiring him to win them over, to submit to the one God, and therefore, of course, to himself, Muhammad, as the final vehicle of revelation. Muhammad saw himself as being in the line of the prophets, sent to warn the people and to condemn the pagan Arabs, condemn the Jews and Christians who refused to accept the warning given to them by God through him, by refusing to join the believers who surrendered to God. And that's the meaning of Muslim or Islam, surrender. Those who rejected Muhammad, and many did, of course, at the time, considered him to be possessed. They mocked him. They made a jest of what he claimed to be his revelations, which required of them that they reject their traditional gods. In 623, and this is the beginning of the new calendar, of the Muslim calendar, Muhammad left Mecca and fled to Yathrib. And the map there shows you it's 300 kilometers north of Mecca. Yathrib was actually a Jewish city. And this marks the beginning of their calendar. Yathrib came to be called Medina, which simply means the city of Muhammad. It was his base for the last 10 years of his life, during which he was the head of a growing social, political and religious community. From 623 to 627, he was involved in a fight to the death with his own tribe, the Quraysh from Mecca, from which he and his Muslims finally emerged victorious. Muhammad himself took part in 27 military campaigns between his arrival at Medina and his death. In a modern sense, it would be reasonable to call him a warlord. He led the army and was very strong on this, for God, of course, as he saw it, to protect the newfound religious political group called Islam, and then, in God's name, to get other people to join it, because that was their only way of salvation, as he saw it. Abbé Guy Pagès, in his Interroger l'Islam, a book published in 2013, quotes Muslim historians' accounts of the violence typical of his day that Muhammad used against his enemies. On page 171, he writes, "We read in the biography of Muhammad by Ibn Hisham," so this is a Muslim writing the life story, "that after digging a pit in the square at Medina, Muhammad participated in the decapitation of 600 to 700 males of the Jewish tribe of Ban Quraida. Now, my comment, for what it's worth, is none of this is surprising when we consider the violent times in which Muhammad lived. Every tribe did this to other tribes at that time. Problems arise when we're asked to believe that he behaved in this way, as he claimed, in response to God's instructions. I'll spend a whole session with you soon looking at religious texts and the danger of claiming God as the author. I'll come back to that. So this is all, in a way, understandable historically. And if we consider Muhammad as the one driving it, yes, others did the same. But we're being asked by the Quran to believe that it's actually God commanding us. Then we're in very troublesome waters, and so are the Muslims in troublesome waters. The revelations from the Medina period tend to have a harsher feel about them when we compare them with the earlier revelations of the Mecca period. Here's an example from Surah 9. Muhammad writes, no, the Quran writes, means God writes, don't lose that. When the sacred months have passed, slay the idolaters wherever you find them, capture them, besiege them, and lie in wait for them in every place of ambush. The authors of the study Quran admit that it's not always possible to be certain what parts of a surah, and I'll talk about that shortly, that's the individual, you can't call them chapters, because they're a mishmash of material. They don't even have one theme. They have a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of something else, and they have found their shape and they're given a name, the Surah 1, 2, 214. So in there, it's hard sometimes to know what parts of the Surah came from Mecca, an earlier, I'll say gentler period, and what parts come from Medina. So I'll let you know when the scholars agree. Otherwise, I'll tell you with a question mark. The scholars, the Islamic scholars, are not sure. The Razidun Caliphate of Medina. So that's where Islam began. After Muhammad's death, Abu Bakr was the first caliph. He lasted 2 years. He was assassinated. He was succeeded by Umar ibn al-Khattab, who was there for 10 years. And then by Uthman ibn Affan. And it was Uthman, the third caliph after Muhammad, who gathered the seven most famous memorizers of the revelations. Because Muhammad didn't actually write anything. He spoke from a mystical state sometimes, and others heard and remembered. He gathered the seven most famous memorizers of the revelations, and from them, and from the many documentary remains and memories, Uthman created the official edition of the Quran. Because the text is a consonantal text, as is Hebrew. There are no vowels in it. Vowels can be put in by points and were later in both languages. Because it's a consonantal text lacking vowels, there are many words which are capable of more than one meaning, which is always a problem for Islamic scholars and people like myself trying to manage it. We'll see examples of this when we come to look at the surahs. And this is a very different process from the way the Christian New Testament emerged. So this Quran was determined by the third of the caliphs, who then burnt and destroyed everything that was contradictory and established the official text. The New Testament, I hope you know, gradually found form by usage. No one said you can't have that and you can't have that and drop that and you must use this. And it's just that communities read Mark's gospel and liked it because it expressed their faith. So they copied it, cherished it, handed it on to their kids and spread copies around. Same with Mark, Luke, John, Matthew, Paul. They grew through that method of people recognizing their faith in these lovely texts. Other things were written in the century after the New Testament, as you probably know, the Gospel of nearly everybody, Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of someone else. They're not sometimes without value in them, but the community didn't welcome them, didn't want them read, they didn't express their faith. And when all you got to do is read them to see why. They survived in the Egyptian desert in pots and that because of the dry nature of things. And now they've emerged, and I've got two volumes of them in my room if you want to read them, of texts that belong to the Apocrypha. They're Apocrypha because the people at the time, they belonged to little tribal groups who fitted Christianity into their already fixed view of things. So they used Christianity, and some of it perhaps nicely, but they weren't converted to the words of the New Testament. Uthman was succeeded by Ali, and this is important because people in the Shiite Muslim group looked to Ali as their kind of founder, you could call it. He was the husband of Muhammad's daughter, Fatima. Ali was assassinated in 661, and his son, with 72 companions, was killed at Karbala in today's Iraq. Thus led to the Sunni Shia schism, which is still tearing that part of the world apart. It all comes from this murder of Ali and then the murder of his son and 72 others by other Muslim groups, Sunni groups. The Rasidun Caliphate of Medina was succeeded by the Umayyad Caliphate of Damascus. So the controlling of the religious political movement called Islam happened now from Damascus. And finally, the Quran. The Quran is divided into 114 surahs, sections. As we shall see when examining the surahs, many of them move through a number of themes and contain material from different periods. For the most part, the surahs are arranged according to length. And that was a common practice at the time. It's the same in the New Testament. If you look at Paul's letters, the longest one, Romans, is first, and the shortest one, Philemon, is last. Same here. Well, the first one for them is really special. It stands apart. But then the second surah is the longest of the surahs. It goes on and on and on. The final one is a couple of lines long. So you've been very lovely, and I hope I haven't lambasted you with it too much. But I wanted just to give an overall picture as best I could so that I can start into the themes tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'll